I stared into his eyes, and I found them honest. But for some reason which I couldn't readily place, I couldn't bring myself to think too much about what Nathan said without feeling as though he was exaggerating the effect of the new atmosphere on me. "This place," he mentioned it when he looked around, a cigarette dangling from his fingers. He continued in a low voice, "It's not what it seems to be." There had been no eeriness in his statement. It had simply been a statement, like one would casually say as a salutation to a neighbor. Nathan was handsome, by most definitions, of what a good-looking man would be, and he was one of the first people I spoke to when I recently moved into my new home. The suburban estate was quiet, a world away from a bustle of the city, where I had spent most of my adult life with my ex-husband. A messy divorce, a noisy city that penetrated my senses, and a stalking, violent ex-husband made this new house a home for me. I mentioned the issue to Nathan once in our conversation, but I was sure that he hadn't enough presence of mind to measure what I really meant by everything. The Lessards, my neighbors, from a few houses down the same row, visited a few weeks after I had settled in. Unlike Nathan, they seemed more cheerful about the place, both bespeckled with such supple facial skin that did not betray their age. I discovered the Lessards to be very fond of humor. When one spoke, the other always seemed to have an accompanying laughter for it. And to avoid an awkward confrontation, I soon found myself laughing at everything that was said by them either. By the end of their second visit to my home, a stop by in a walk, I was told by the couple that they were part of the neighborhood watch. They were part of the families that had moved into the area when it was very sparse, and they said that a lot had changed when they first moved in. "It's become a very busy place since we moved here, Ava. People have moved into the neighborhood and some have left," Miss Lessard said to me, and I chuckled when Mr. Lessard did, even though I thought it was weird that she had said it like that. "But you're safe here, Ava." Mr. Lessard nodded his head to punctuate what his wife had been saying. "If you need anything, you can come to us and we'll help." I found myself at peace in the new neighborhood, regardless of what Nathan or the Lessards had said, and I was determined to keep it that way. Weeks rolled by slowly, and I became better with the quietness in the mornings and the strange stillness of the air at noon. At dusk, I would walk around to take in the atmosphere of my new neighborhood. I did this walk habitually, until I noticed something weird under very strange circumstances. Most of the houses in the neighborhood were numbered like I had expected them to be, but under their numberings, I noticed symbols which I couldn't readily identify. For the houses that had those symbols, I never saw anyone come in or out of them. I talked to Nathan about it without stressing how uncomfortable it made me, and he smiled with his eyes dead on me and told me that he said all that he could say. The neighborhood had strange things happened every other time, and the news of it never made it out. I asked what it was that he had seen. Nathan took a long drag of his cigarette and smiled. Perhaps he said it was the neighborhood watch who had put those symbols under the numbers of those houses, which occupants did not comply with their regulations. With that, I was dismissed. But I did not leave without a sense of caution that there was something Nathan was hiding. My nightmares translated to reality quickly when my cat went missing by the end of the same week that I had expressed my fears to Nathan. My first instinct was anger. I had a sense that I was being messed with, so I rushed to Nathan's house, which was just by mine. "Open up, you sick freak!" I yelled at the door in anger that he had taken my cat to play games with me. My anger waned and frustration kicked in when I knocked repeatedly, but there was no response to my call. Exhaustion induced common sense, and I returned to my house to search for the tracker which I had put on my cat. I broke out sweating when I found my cat's location was further down the street, away from Nathan's house. I wondered if it had simply strayed, and I took it upon myself to go look for it. My heart pounded in my chest, and my entire body trembled as I braved the night in search of my cat, guided by the tracker. Dread and apprehension from whatever the black, quiet night held terrified me. I watched over my shoulder every step of the way until I finally arrived at the Lessard shed. The elderly couple's offering of help rang in my head, and I debated within myself briefly if it was appropriate that I walk up to the shed and pick up my cat, or if I should just ask their permission. My sense of urgency got the better of me, and I stumbled into the shed myself. Every assurance that I had mustered when I walked into the open fell off me like layers of an onion bulb, and a cold sweat tingled from my spine when the unmistakable smell of blood hit my nostrils. I ran my hand over my mouth to stifle my cry of shock as my eyes roamed over disturbing materials lying around the floor with no care. I was sure my beating heart could be heard all around the neighborhood because it was almost deafening my ears. My limbs shook as I scoured over bloodied surgical tools which laid on the table, supported by a bucket that seemed to contain something macabre. On the wall, I saw a blueprint of the neighborhood with the same symbols I had seen earlier. The markings under them were non-compliant. I didn't have the stomach to look at it, as the idea of such mindless violence of what happened to them is terrorizing me. My legs took cue, and just as I turned to leave, the door shut behind me. "We knew you would come. You have been non-compliant," Mrs. Lessard said with a wry smile on her face. Mr. Lessard appeared out of the shadows at this time. He didn't laugh at what was being said. "Please," I pleaded, tears running loose from my eyes. "They'll never find your body," Mr. Lessard assured me. There was nowhere to run, and the evil couple was blocking my means of escape. And in my mind, I prayed for a quick death, even though I suspected their sick minds would not allow them to pass up the chance to torture me. I fell to my knees in defeat when all of a sudden, the door banged open, and Nathan was there with a gun in hand. "Nobody move. The cops are on their way. I didn't call an ambulance for the dead bodies," he said. "Oh, thank you, Nathan. This lady burgled her way into our garden and tried to steal from us," Mrs. Lessard lied, feigning hurt as she approached Nathan. Nathan had the good sense to turn the gun on her with a menacing look in his face that he would not hesitate to shoot. "I know what you are, and I'll testify to your crimes. Ava, come over here," he said to me, and I never ran so fast towards a person as I ran to Nathan. The police arrived in no time to arrest the Lessards, and the evidence of all the murders they had committed in the neighborhood came to light when their house was searched. I asked Nathan how he knew to come save me. He said that he followed me after I knocked on his door and knew what the Lessards were capable of, but all he needed was proof of it.
"Are you sure this address is correct?" I said, staring at the details of my next pizza delivery. My coworker Alex shrugged, already moving on to preparing the next delivery. "It's the one they gave us. It's probably just some teens who decided to order pizza while messing around. It's already been paid for, so just go and deliver it already." I sighed, hauling the insulated bag into my arms. "All right then, see you in a bit." The address in question belonged to the abandoned high school that sat on the outskirts of town. I wasn't a local, so I didn't know the full story, but apparently some kind of tragedy had caused the school to close down several years ago, and it had since fallen into serious disrepair. Now, only homeless people and teenagers ever bothered to go out there. I climbed into my car, punched the address into the GPS, and started driving, hoping this wasn't just some stupid prank. It was a busy Friday night, and I still had a lot of deliveries to make. As I got closer to the abandoned school, the streets seemed to get darker and more deserted, until I was in a completely empty neighborhood. I pulled the car up outside the imposing structure of the school, doused in complete shadow, and swallowed back the flutter of anxiety in my chest. Just make the delivery and get the hell out of there. That's all I had to do. I'd been hoping to find the customer waiting outside for me, but the schoolyard was completely empty. "Don't tell me they're inside," I muttered to myself, glancing towards the entrance. The door was sitting wide open, like a maw in the darkness. Taking a deep breath, I walked up to it. "Hello? Pizza delivery?" I called into the opening, peering inside. Nobody there. Was this just a prank after all? Dragging me all the way out here just for the hell of it? With a sigh, I was about to turn back when I heard the squeak of footsteps from inside the school. There was someone in there. Did someone order pizza? I called again. Somewhere in a very faint voice, I thought I heard someone say, "This way." Did they want me to go inside? Grumbling under my breath, I stepped over the threshold, feeling debris crack and shift under my heel. They better give me a damn good tip for this. "This way," the voice whispered again, making me shiver. Why did it sound so close, yet so far away at the same time? "I ain't messing around," I called, my voice echoing strangely down the hallway. "I'm gonna leave your pizza here, okay?" "This way," the voice said again, but I ignored it, setting the pizza box on the ground. I had to get back or I'd be scolded by my superior. I turned around, ready to head back to the exit, and froze. The exit was no longer behind me. Instead, the corridor twisted into another one, one that hadn't been there before. "What the hell?" I muttered, staring in bewilderment at the passage behind me. Had I taken a turn somewhere and not realized? I could have sworn I'd walked in a straight line this whole time. Pushing down that fear in my stomach, I went back the way I'd come, expecting to see the door leading back outside. But it wasn't there. Instead, another long hallway had taken its place, leading into darkness. What the hell was going on? Was I hallucinating? I reached up and rubbed my eyes, but the scene before me didn't change. I was surrounded by endless corridors, a labyrinth of classrooms and lockers and broken notice boards, yellowed flyers fluttering in an invisible draught. I turned back around and tried going towards where I thought I'd left the pizza, but that had disappeared too. What was happening? It was almost like the school was changing around me, distorting into some kind of maze that I couldn't escape. "Hello? Is anyone there?" I shouted, hoping someone might hear and come to my rescue. But I could already tell the school was empty. It had been from the start. But whose voice had I been hearing earlier? "This way." I gave a start. From the corner of my eye, I thought I saw someone standing at the other end of the corridor, a tall, thin figure. But when I turned to look, there was nothing there. Should I go that way? With no other option, I decided to follow the voice and the mysterious figure that had been lingering on the edge of my periphery. "This way." There it was again, that faint, breathy whisper that almost sounded like a gust of wind. Was it really someone here, or was I just hearing things? The deeper into the school I went, the more run down and dilapidated things grew. Shadows seeped out from the doorways, glass crunched underfoot from broken windows, and a stale, musty smell began to assault my senses. Whenever I reached a crossroads, with passages stretching in all directions, I would hear that faint, ghostly voice whisper to me, and a glimpse of a shadow amongst the darkness, and I would follow it, not knowing if it was leading me out of here or deeper into the school's spiderweb of corridors. Finally, after what felt like hours, the air began to feel lighter, no longer stale and oppressive. Something fluttered down the corridor towards me, riding on a gust of wind. Did that mean the exit was close? I caught the newspaper before it went past, the edges torn and yellowed from age. The headline made my eyes widen. "Death of a high school teacher exposes the dirty game of the headmaster, causes school to close indefinitely." Is that what happened here? Is that why the school was shut down, a bad headmaster? How horrible. It was no wonder this place had such a bad air to it. As I lowered the paper and I looked up, I found myself back in a familiar place. The pizza box that I'd left was sitting at my feet, and the exit was directly ahead of me, as if it had been there the whole time. Without pausing to think about it, I ran towards the door, finally stumbling out into the fresh air. I'd finally made it out of there. When I checked the time, only 5 minutes had passed since I'd arrived in the car. Then everything I'd just experienced, had it been some kind of elaborate dream? A trick on my mind? When I glanced back towards the school, I thought, just for a moment, that there was someone standing in one of the broken, darkened windows. But then I blinked and there was nothing there after all. I was standing at the edge of the cliff, the wind whipping around me, cold and unforgiving. Below, the waves crashed against the rocks, each one echoing the turmoil in my heart. How had it come to this? Betrayal, lies, and deceit, all wrapped up in the guise of family loyalty. It all began in 2020, a year already stained with chaos and uncertainty. My mom, a woman whose bitterness seemed to grow with each passing day, started her relentless campaign. She wanted my dad's shares in the family's corporation. The bylaws were clear. Only lineal descendants could own them. But my mom, never one to be deterred by rules, believed she deserved them for enduring the so-called burden of my in-laws. "Would you give me your shares when your dad passes away?" she asked one evening, her eyes sharp and calculating. "Your sister already said yes. Will you?" Her words stung, but I stood my ground. "No, I won't," I replied firmly. The anger in her eyes was palpable, but I didn't care. I wouldn't be bullied into submission. Later, I confided in my dad. He listened quietly, his face a mask of concern. "Don't worry about it," he said finally. "I'll take care of it." A week later, my mom approached me, a triumphant glint in her eye. She handed me a document, an addendum signed by both my dad and my uncle, granting her the shares. "Dad asked me not to show you this," she said, her voice dripping with satisfaction. "But I thought you should know." My heart sank. I hoped it was a forgery, a desperate attempt by my mom to manipulate the situation. But my uncle confirmed it. He had signed it, they both had. The betrayal cut deep, but it wasn't just the shares. It was the realization of how vile my mom truly was. The woman who was supposed to protect and nurture had become a predator, tearing our family apart for her own gain. I withdrew from my mom and sister, going no contact, hoping distance would bring clarity. But the anger festered, a constant gnawing presence. I couldn't escape it. I started digging, looking for any way to reverse the addendum, any legal loophole that could restore the balance. One night, I found myself in the old family cabin, a place that held so many memories. I was sifting through boxes of documents, searching for something, anything, when I stumbled upon an old journal. It belonged to my mom. The entries were filled with venom, detailing her resentment towards my dad, my in-laws, even us kids. But one entry stood out. It was from 2005, the year my sister was born. She wrote about an affair. How she had planned to leave my dad but stayed for the sake of appearances and financial security. I felt a surge of conflicting emotions, anger, betrayal, and a dark, unsettling satisfaction. My mom wasn't just a manipulative schemer. She was a liar, living a double life. I had to confront her. I waited until the next family gathering, a somber affair given the tension. I cornered my mom in the kitchen, the journal clutched in my hand. "What's this?" I demanded, shoving the open page in her face. Her eyes widened and narrowed. "Where did you get that?" she hissed. "Does it matter? You lied to all of us. You were going to leave Dad, but you stayed for the money." She laughed, a cold, bitter sound. "And you think you're any better? You're just like him, clinging to those shares, to the power they represent." I was shaking with rage. "You don't deserve them. You never did." She stepped closer, her voice a low whisper. "Maybe not. But I have them now, and there's nothing you can do about it." As she turned to leave, I noticed a familiar glint in her eye, the same one she had when she showed me the addendum. It hit me then, like a bolt of lightning. She had orchestrated this whole thing,
Not just to get the shares, but to destroy me. To turn me against my dad. I couldn't let her win. I had to find a way to expose her. To show the world who she really was. I spent the next few months gathering evidence. Digging into her past, her finances, her connections. The more I found, the darker the picture became. My mom wasn't just a bitter woman. She was involved in illegal activities, using the family's corporation as a front. I went to the authorities, hoping they would take action, but the process was slow, and my mom was always one step ahead. She knew I was coming for her, and she retaliated with a vengeance. She spread rumors, turned family and friends against me, and even tried to frame me for embezzlement. I was spiraling, losing everything I had worked for. One night, I found myself back at the cliff, the waves crashing below, a bottle of whiskey in hand. I felt a strange sense of peace, a resignation to my fate. But then I remembered my dad, my sister, even my in-laws. They deserved better. I couldn't let my mom's poison spread any further. I made one last call to a journalist friend. I handed over all the evidence, every dirty secret I had uncovered. It was my final act of defiance. The story broke, and the fallout was immediate. My mom was arrested, the corporation was investigated, and the shares were frozen. But the damage was done. Our family was shattered, trust destroyed beyond repair. I stood at the edge of the cliff, watching the waves, feeling the weight of my decisions. I had won, but at what cost? The victory was hollow. The future uncertain. In the end, I walked away, leaving the past behind, knowing that some scars never heal, and some betrayals are never forgiven.
My husband Tim and I always threw a 4th of July barbecue in our neighborhood. It was a tradition we'd done for nearly a decade, and it was always a highlight of our year. Tim was responsible for the food and fireworks, while I was in charge of pretty much everything else. This year's party was going to be the biggest we ever had. We ordered tons of food, and I invited all our neighbors. Mostly everybody RSVP'd yes, including our next-door neighbor, William. He'd moved into the community 2 years ago, but he'd never been over to our house. He was a friendly, very good-looking man, but he usually kept to himself. I was surprised that he'd agree to come. On the morning before the party, Tim came to me while I was decorating and asked about the guest list. I told him all the people who said yes, but when I mentioned William's name, he got a really weird look on his face. "Are you sure that's a good idea?" he asked. "Inviting William?" I asked. "Of course it is. It would be rude to invite everyone else except him." "Fine," he said angrily. Then he left to buy the fireworks. It was clear that he didn't want William to come to our party, but I had no idea why. I didn't think he'd had a single conversation with William. And the only time I'd ever talked to William for longer than a minute was back when I helped him move in 2 full years ago. Tim had no reason to dislike our neighbor. Tim returned about an hour later with tons of sparklers and other small-scale fireworks. I had finished setting up all the tables and decoration, so I asked if he needed help setting up the fireworks. "No," he shouted. "I can do this myself. I don't want you to hurt yourself." I thought that was a very strange thing to say. By noon, the first guests had arrived. Pretty soon, our backyard was filled with all our friends. Tim seemed to be in surprisingly high spirits, but I worried that his attitude would change once William showed up. I was wrong. When William arrived, Tim ran over and greeted him like they were long-lost brothers. I instantly relaxed, thinking that I'd misinterpreted his feelings completely. The party seemed to go off without a hitch. With country music blaring from our speakers, Tim served up his burgers and hot dogs, and I sat with the guests. I ended up sitting next to William, and I finally got to learn more about him. He was a fireman for the county, divorced and single. He spent his free time racing hot rods. Overall, he seemed like a really interesting person, despite being somewhat introverted. When we were done eating, Tim gathered everyone to the center of the yard and handed out sparklers and little cherry bombs for us to light. You can't have a 4th of July barbecue without some fireworks, but we always went for the smaller, safer ones. The yard was filled with smoke and lights as we each lit up our tiny fireworks. It was a beautiful moment. William seemed especially excited to participate. Once all the sparklers died down, Tim brought out the next set of fireworks. These were a bit stronger, the kind that you lit on the ground and then had to back away from before they exploded. He'd never gotten this kind before, but I trusted him. He wouldn't buy anything that was too powerful. One by one, Tim passed out the new fireworks to everyone at the party. William was the last guest to take one. I was too far away to hear what Tim told him as he handed it over, but I noticed that William's expression turned a little suspicious when he took it. I didn't know why. Once everyone was ready, Tim climbed up onto a bench and explained the rules. Everyone needed to light their fireworks on the ground and then step back at least 3 feet. He seemed to take the safety rules very seriously. Then he started to count down so that we could all set off our fireworks at the same time. As he was counting down, William walked up to me. "You didn't get one," he said. He was right. Tim and I didn't have fireworks of our own. Then William handed me his. "Take mine. I'm a fireman, remember? I see this stuff all the time." "Sure," I said, and I took the firework box and lighter from his hands. By then, the countdown ended, and I lit mine just like everybody else. What happened next was a total blur. Just as I lit my fuse, Tim jumped off the bench and dove toward me. He grabbed me by the shoulders and pulled me back, just as the fireworks exploded. All the other fireworks did exactly what they were supposed to do. They shot streaks of light into the air. It was really beautiful. But my firework didn't work like that. Instead, it exploded like a bomb. It was the loudest noise I'd ever heard. If Tim hadn't pulled me back, I would have died. Smoke was everywhere, and my ears were ringing terribly. I looked down at Tim, who had gotten between me and the explosion. He was lying on the ground, burnt. I couldn't tell how hurt he was, but it seemed pretty bad. He was also unconscious. Thankfully, someone called 911 right away. An ambulance came and lifted Tim onto a stretcher. As they were taking him away, William walked over and put his hand on my shoulder. "I think your husband was trying to kill me," he said. "What?" I shouted. William explained that he'd seen firework-related accidents before. As a fireman, he could tell when explosives had been tampered with, and he knew that Tim had stuffed his firework box with extra gunpowder. Rather than call him out on it, he gave the explosive to me.
"Why?"
I asked.
"Because I thought you were in on it too," he said.
Confused and shell-shocked, I got into the ambulance with Tim and rode to the hospital. I ended up sitting in the hospital waiting room for an hour before a doctor told me that Tim had regained consciousness. I went to his room, where his face was covered in bandages. His arms were bandaged up to the wrists. Both of his hands had been torn off in the explosion. He looked up at me when I entered.
"It wasn't supposed to be like this," he said.
Very slowly, he explained that he had suspected me and William of having an affair. All because he saw me leave his house after I'd helped him move in.
I never thought that Tim was a jealous person, and he'd never mentioned his suspicions to me before, but I guess the anger had eaten up at him until he hatched his plan to strike back at our neighbor.
I calmly told him that William and I were not having an affair, and if he'd actually gotten to know our neighbor, he would have realized that William was a fireman who'd recognize a tampered firework when he saw one. My husband is still in the hospital, going through physical therapy and learning to use his new prosthetic hooks. If I were a stronger person, I'd be helping him recover. But knowing that he'd done this to himself, that he'd actually tried to murder someone, I've decided to file for divorce. I haven't talked to William since the party, but I figured it was best if I just kept my distance.
Every day was a new lesson at McDonald's.
I'm 19, working at a fast food joint to make some extra cash for my upcoming trip to Cyprus. Serving burgers and fries to all sorts of people, some nice, others not so much, had become my daily grind. It was fascinating, though. Interacting with different people made the mundane shifts a bit more bearable. Among our regulars was a homeless man, always standing with his sign, smiling at the passing cars. He'd occasionally come in to swap his change for notes or to buy coffee. We all knew him. He was polite, kind, and always had a good word for everyone. His name was Tom. One chilly evening, Tom came in with his usual jar of change. His eyes lit up as he approached the counter. "A large caramel frappe, please. Lots of cream, lots of sauce," he said, his voice cheerful despite the cold. I punched in his order but accidentally made it a medium. I quickly told the girl on Bev cell to add extra cream and sauce, making it look like a large. When I handed it to him, his face lit up like a Christmas tree. He giggled, thanked us multiple times, and walked out to a nearby bench, savoring every sip of his drink. That $3 frappe had made his day. Watching him, I realized how much we take for granted. Here was a man whose entire week was brightened by a simple drink. My own upbringing wasn't exactly privileged, raised by a single mom since I was 9, but we got by. I had a job, free food on my breaks, and a decent paycheck. Yet I had never felt such gratitude for these little things. The next day, something was off. Tom didn't show up at his usual spot. Days passed, and he was still nowhere to be seen. Concern gnawed at me. One evening, I decided to check the alleyway where he usually slept. What I found made my blood run cold. Tom was lying there, beaten and unconscious. Beside him was a note scribbled in a shaky hand. "I just wanted to make people smile." I called 911 and the paramedics arrived quickly. They said he'd been attacked but would recover. The police launched an investigation, but the assailant was never found. It haunted me. Who could do such a thing to someone as kind as Tom? Weeks passed, and Tom slowly recovered. I visited him in the hospital, bringing him his favorite caramel frappe. He smiled weakly, grateful as ever. "I didn't know people could be so cruel," he said, his voice trembling. "But I also didn't know people like you existed. Thank you." Tom's words stuck with me. How could the world be so heartless, yet so capable of kindness? I wanted to do more to help him. So I started a fundraiser at work. To my surprise, the response was overwhelming. Customers, colleagues, even strangers pitched in. Within weeks, we raised enough to get Tom a small apartment and a job at a local shelter. The twist came when I discovered who had attacked him. It was a group of local teens, bored and looking for trouble. One of them, Mike, was a regular at our McDonald's. I confronted him, my heart pounding. "Why did you do it?" I asked, anger and sadness mixing in my voice. Mike looked ashamed, avoiding my gaze.
"We didn't think... I didn't think, he stammered. We were just messing around."
"Messing around?" I echoed, disbelief in my voice. "You almost killed him." Mike apologized, and I saw genuine regret in his eyes. He agreed to volunteer at the shelter where Tom now worked, seeking redemption. Tom's recovery and the community's support restored my faith in humanity. We had our flaws, our dark sides, but kindness could prevail. It wasn't just about the big gestures. Sometimes, it was just a simple caramel frappe that made all the difference. As I prepared for my trip to Cyprus, I felt a new sense of purpose. Life had its cruelties, but also its moments of profound beauty. And in those moments, we found our humanity. Be kind, I reminded myself. Be kind.